This is the Education Gadfly Show.
End of discussion. I dropped the mic right there.
Huh? Yeah, I think
David's not going to let you go that quickly.
What does Gadfly say?
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now, please join me in welcoming my co-hosts, the Michigan Wolverines of Education Reform, Alyssa Schwenk and David Griffith.
You know, here I thought you were going to go with a reference that mocked Duke or was about South Carolina, but that was short-sighted of me.
Yeah, come on. Yeah. This is a chance for me to celebrate my Michigan Wolverines playing some great basketball, making it into the Sweet 16, part of this amazing Big Ten crew that is going pretty far, crushing the ACC. Except for Roberts, North Carolina.
They're hanging in there.
It kind of kills me that Robert may still win the Fordham Institute office pool by picking North Carolina because his daughter goes there.
Well, my final was Villanova versus Wichita State, so I am not winning the pool.
I mean, Alyssa, Wichita State? Really?
I thought they were going to go on a streak and I was going to be like hailed as a genius in retrospect.
That was bold.
I continue to protest the entire annual ceremony by not participating.
I know.
That's really sad for you.
Yeah, I saw something, 73% of Americans say they look forward to going to work more because of March Madness, participating in March Madness. So you would be, this would help.
We are the 27%.
Come on. Debbie Downers out there. All right. Go blue. Still got some tough games ahead of us. But hey, excited. We made this far.
It's going to be a good week.
All right, but we're not here. We're not a basketball podcast. We're not a March Madness podcast. We are an education reform podcast. And now it's time for Ed Reform Update. All right, guys, we are going to talk about the president's budget. Woohoo! And the reason is everybody else is talking about it, so I feel compelled that we have to talk about it too.
I think that's a fair reason.
Question number one, should people out there care at all about the president's budget? David, Alyssa?
I would say yes.
Oh, interesting. Yes. That goes against the conventional wisdom because the conventional wisdom is it is but a recommendation, which will be completely ignored by the folks on Capitol
Hill.
True,
and it will. But I think people should care about it because I think it's insightful about, what a president is thinking through, etc. I don't think it will get passed. That was not the question.
Okay. All right. So if, for example, somebody is worried about some of the funding cuts proposed or excited about some of the new choice programs proposed, they should be neither too freaked out nor too excited at this point.
They should be holding their breaths.
And David, what do you think?
I am going to go with the conventional wisdom here. Yeah. People should not care.
Yeah.
I tried to think of something more interesting to say, but there it is.
Yeah, David's right on this one. They should not care at all. So that,
you're just mellow this week.
Look, this is what I told the state superintendents this week. I got to speak on a panel along with Lily and Randy from the NEA and the AFT, which was cool, and Gerard from AEI.
And Eric from
EWA. Eric Roblin. It was star-studded, indeed.
All-star.
Gerard, who had a hurt shoulder, which gave him the excuse for why he had to wear sunglasses up there. Mostly, he just looked like, Mr. Cool Cat. And then Eric Roblin, who's like a rock star.
He actually was at mile 10 when I did the half marathon a few weeks
ago.
Actually,
that concludes our section on the budget.
Okay, sorry. Exactly. Point is, we're not talking about the budget because it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. Although Randy and Lily, of course, were saying it matters. And they're trying to rally their troops and get people, up in arms about this. That's fine. And look, if you're worried about these cuts, if you're an advocate, you got to go up there, Capitol Hill, and make your case. So I get that. All right. So probably not going to happen. But let's talk substance. Nobody actually wants to talk about the substance. And here's where I really want to ask my friends and colleagues here, David, Alyssa. I know you might be a bit to my left on some of these issues. So let me ask you this. What is the substantive argument for example, the 21st Century Learning Centers program, $1.2 billion? Note, I did not say the argument for providing after-school or summer-school programs to poor kids. There's a strong case for that. But why does the federal government have to pay for this? Why can't local school districts or states or mayors or counties pay for this sort of thing?
I can answer that question because it is extremely difficult to execute a handoff, right? In practice. I mean, you simply can't take something out of the federal budget and make it magically appear in districts all over the country. So I am saying I agree with you.
So there'd be a transition period where there might be a dropped handoff, But that's it. That's the best you got. Right. Okay, we should do it because we've done it. And that's the only
argument. I will push back on this. The areas that need these programs most are frequently the ones with weakest tax base, literally. Mm-hmm. So it would be tough for a poor rural district to offer the sort of after-school programming that is frequently needed to keep kids safe and to provide them with the extended academic support they need, but for the federal government. And I'd make the same case in urban areas as well.
What about states? What about states? There's this thing in between called a state. If they care about their poor areas, they could fund this, right? I mean, look, I think this is a clear case where at some point somebody was very smart to get a bunch of federal money for after school and summer school programs. And now that we've been doing it for a decade or whatever, it's hard to stop doing.
Yeah, I'm a centrist on this, Mike. I mean, there are rich states and poor states. You know, it is not as dramatic as the difference between neighborhoods within a city by any means.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think there's a role for the federal government, you know, to an equity role for the federal government.
All right, so I got a deal.
Yeah.
We'll just stop giving these grants to the rich states. That's fine. I'd be okay with that.
Yeah.
So we would just give it to the poor states?
Yeah. By the way, mostly Republican leaning and, you know, so in the heartland, that's fine. We'll just give them the money and we'll stop giving the money to New York.
There are poor areas of New York, I would argue.
But they've got plenty of tax money that they can use at the state level. All right. What about Title II? Title II, we're talking about $2 billion.
Yes.
Okay, for teacher stuff, there's like a list of 24 things that states and districts can do with this money. Much of it sounds pretty good. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of innovative stuff. And then you look into whatever the latest evaluation or the reports are, and you find out, what are they actually spending the money on? You know what they're spending the money on? Teacher salaries. Almost entirely. Teacher salaries. So let me ask a question again. Why should the federal government be paying teacher salaries?
Well, let me point out again that several rural states have pointed out that it's difficult to pay teachers competitive salaries and keep them in the rural states, if not for the Title II money.
Oh, come on. No, listen, this is not making... This is talking about $2 billion out of $650 billion nationwide. This is fairy dust here, right? This is... All this is doing is decreasing class size from, you know, 26 to 24, maybe. Mm-hmm. Okay? And look, make the argument that's an essential need, but really... Isn't that something, again, that if Iowa really wants to keep its class sizes at 24, cough up a little bit of extra money?
Now I would use David's argument that it is tough to magically take something out of the federal government's budget and just make sure that states do it. And I would also argue that several state governments are even more conservative than Congress right now. So getting them to redistribute wealth, because that is what you're asking them to do, I would argue would be politically unlikely.
Listen, I'll turn on my inner radical here a little bit. you're right. Like, look,
definitely not into me.
I would like to be right.
Why don't we just stop there, David? We had this discussion before. When you said to me, you're right, that's a good place to end the podcast. Now, go ahead. All right.
But, I mean, look, the evaluations of these things are not that strong, right? I mean, frequently when you look at the actual impact studies, the evidence is incredibly mixed, and that leaves you in sort of a tough place if you think that poor kids deserve help and the sort of intent of these programs is good. You know, I would argue that something like, for example, early childhood, right? We ought to be reforming rather than cutting.
Mm-hmm.
Some of these others, you know, I think the other thing that probably is just rubbing people the wrong way is the context of it, right? I mean, we're eliminating or downsizing literally hundreds of things to pay for a marginal increase in defense, right? So you can question almost any item in the government's budget and you will not find a randomized controlled trial proving that it is cost effective.
That's true.
So,
and yes, in many of the federal programs in education, it's about formula funds. And look, I think the good government approach is to say, hey, we believe in money following the child as much as possible. We certainly agree that poor kids have greater needs and cost more to educate. And so the federal government, it's appropriate to provide extra money for poor kids. So ideally what you do is you put all the money into Title I. You just, you know, which is very targeted. The targeting has improved from, you know, the recent decades. Put the money in Title I and get rid of all the other stuff. You know, instead of these specialized programs in K-12, get rid, you know. And if a Title I school wants to spend its Title I money on lowering class size or on after-school programs, fine. Boom. Done. End of discussion. I dropped the mic right there. Huh?
Yeah, I think
David's not going to let you go that quickly.
Yeah, well, no, I'm not going to. I am going to let him go that quickly. I don't think that we hear that message often enough from conservatives, right? I mean, I think that's not what's coming across to people.
Yeah,
is not what you just said. I think what they're hearing is cuts, and I'm going to have to dig into it some more. But I mean, I don't know that that is necessarily what's being proposed, right? So,
well, they are increasing Title I.
They're increasing Title I.
They did not cut Title I. That's important, right? Yeah. When they cut so much else, right? They're cutting the NEA and they're cutting the NEH and they're cutting, NPR and everything else. I told this joke yesterday. I heard a guy who runs Arts for America. He's in this band in D.C. And there's like a guy from the NEA, the Arts NEA, from the NEH, from NPR. They're thinking about calling themselves the Basket of Defundables. Oof. That was pretty good.
Yeah. Oof.
Really? Oof. No laugh. I killed in front of the state superintendents. They loved it.
I'm apparently a tough crowd today.
Oh my God. All right. Well, so in conclusion, neither David nor Alyssa can come up with compelling arguments for keeping these federal programs. And yet we all agree that they will be kept nonetheless.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
That is all the time we've got. For Ed Reform Update, now it's everyone's favorite, Amber's Research Minute. Amber, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Mike.
It feels like months since you've been on the show.
So long. I've been missed, right?
You have been missed.
In Amber's defense, she was on it 1 week that you were not on it.
I was thinking about handing this over to David just permanently, to be David's research minute.
Well, it's really nice to have a rock star substitute.
Yes, and that is true. And I will say, I think I just got him to agree that a lot of these federal programs that the president wants to cut are superfluous.
Really, really big move. Really, I'd like to hear more. I'm sure he'll tell me more later.
Well, if we've increased other programs like Title I, maybe.
Yes.
So I do have to ask you, Amber, are you rooting for UNC?
I am not. Well, I had Louisville winning the whole thing.
Yes.
I had Villanova.
And I had Duke.
So, here we are.
Yeah. All right. Excellent. But my dad
lives in North Carolina, so I do have a fondness, and I used to teach in North Carolina, I'm on board with them.
All right. All right. There we go. No, the right answer is Michigan. Go Blue. Come on, baby.
At this point, my bracket is so busted that I will just root for whatever.
Like on top one day.
I think 29 out of 32 picks right in the first round.
Yeah. Yeah.
And in the second round, which is 16 games, I think I've gotten 5 right.
Yeah.
Ooh. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's tough.
It's bad.
How the mighty fall.
Yes.
Okay, Amber, what you got for us?
I have a new study out by Calder. We all know that CTE is just the new thing. So they have a study that examines the modern career academies.
Ooh.
And how they attract and who they attract, basically, and what are their causal impacts.
Ooh.
Okay. So recall that there was this great big seminal lottery-based research from MDRC on career academies. It's been about a decade ago, which I didn't think it had been that long.
Yeah.
So they did a bunch of studies on the career academies in the 90s. Mm-hmm. Just a little quick reminder, they found no effects for high school graduation or initial college outcomes, but they did find that males in particular had higher salaries over the long term, and they were more likely to form and sustain families.
Yeah.
Yeah,
huh. Yeah. Higher marriage rates and more likely to have custody of their kids.
Really neat research.
Yeah.
The authors here suggest that since then, we really haven't had much rigorous research on career academies, in part due to this new emphasis on college and career readiness and the fact that we had this economic recession. And it means that basically they say we need a new generation of experimental research on the latest CTE career academies and models. So guess what? Here it is.
I love it.
Dun, dun,
all right.
Dun.
So they examine career academies in Wake County. It has 20. I don't know much about Wake County, but apparently they have 20 career academies in 14 high schools, which is a lot. For the descriptive part of the analysis, they examine all first-time ninth graders in 2014-15 and 2015-16. They find that, and this is a little surprising, career academy enrollees are less likely to be minority, more likely to be male, and are higher achieving than their peers within the same schools who did not enroll in the career academy.
That is
interesting. This is not your grandfather's.
The achievement piece, I think, is encouraging.
That's right. It's attracting, sort of a different type of student. Mm-hmm. For the causal analysis, they examine outcomes for just one large career academy called Apex Academy of Information Technology.
Heard of this one.
Have you?
Yeah.
They admit students by lottery, and they've done that since 2009 because they get about twice as many applications as they have seats. So they're able to approximate a randomized control trial and identify causal impacts of participation in the career academy on a bunch of measures. Okay. It's about 500 students in the final sample. All right. And you want to know a little bit about what they do, just a little bit, right? So Apex Academy has their biggest thing is they have a technology paid internship for all juniors.
Mm-hmm. That's why kids want to do it.
They have to go
in
out.
In the research triangle.
In the research triangle. And they have a 4-year sequence of IT courses. They have to take this pretty elaborate sequence of courses, and they give them a bunch of soft skills training, you know, how to work in a workplace, I'm guessing. Lots of causal findings. Number one, analysts find that enrolling in APEX increases the likelihood of graduating from high school by about 8 percentage points.
Ooh,
pretty good.
Wow.
Yeah, pretty good. Mostly driven by the impacts on males.
Mm-hmm.
The Academy also increased the likelihood of college attendance within 1 year of graduation by about 8 percentage points.
Mm-hmm. Huh, also good.
Pretty good. It had no impact on the type of college enrolled. Okay. Overall, this effect on college, again, is driven mostly by males.
Right.
Mm-hmm. It shows that about 90% of male attenders in the Career Academy will attend college versus about 78% of their non-Academy male counterparts. It's pretty
impressive.
Even the ones that applied to this.
That's right.
Yeah.
And the Career Academy also reduced the number of absences for a typical ninth grader by about 1.4 days. All right, now for what it didn't do. No effect of APEX enrollment on academic achievement on average or for specific subgroups as measured by the ACT, because North Carolina is one of those states where all high school juniors have to take the ACT.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Nor is there impact of APEX enrollment on AP course taking or on the passing the AP exams.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So kind of a mixed bag. Analysts, and summarizing the research, say our evidence suggests that boys responded to this technology-rich applied academic setting of APEX Academy, while girls did not. Obviously, the study just focused on this one Career Academy. We can't apply it elsewhere, yada, yada. But I mean, I guess what I was struck by, because they went through this pretty extensive literature review at the beginning, and they were talking about how this research in, I think it was Charlotte Mecklenburg, was it was a public school lottery there, and they found that a lot of the impacts were sort of, you know, benefiting girls more.
Mm-hmm.
And now we have one benefiting boys more. And then you start thinking about the larger choice research, which is what you've brought up, Mike, before, that sometimes we see some of these interventions benefiting African males or disadvantaged students. So we're beginning to see, I think, a pattern in the literature that says, you know what, we have some nuanced findings about the types of choices and programs that potentially benefit certain types of kids.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's pretty cool.
Absolutely. You know, it is important to say that you can't apply this to other schools. Right. And the fact that it is, you know, that in Wake County, they're attracting high achievers is very encouraging, perhaps unusual, although maybe not. I mean, this is certainly, I've become convinced that you got to be pretty darn high achieving to succeed in these new CTE programs.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's also important to say these randomized experiments, you know, you can only assume that they might have similar findings for other schools that are oversubscribed enough.
Mm-hmm. Right.
To need a lottery.
That's right.
All right. And so that's important as well. And then this thing about not finding test score impacts at high school. I mean, isn't it just hard for high schools to move the needle on student achievement?
Well, yeah, especially at the high school level, right?
There's not a lot of time, right? Yeah, I mean, whatever they're measuring between ninth grade and 11th grade, and, you know, kids are kind of fully baked by then. It's just hard to...
Man, which is sad, right?
Just, you know, I mean, whereas, you know, so these better, I mean, it seems like better measures for high schools, or are they
better getting tests,
more kids into college? I would like to know whether the kids have better success completing college. And I guess what, they don't have those data yet.
I will say something that struck me was something that seemed like it probably confirms what we found in our study of CTE last year, which it sounded like the program and the curricula was really locked down in terms of the kids all get a research internship at the end. To me, that sounds like there's probably some sequencing of the courses to build to something which leads to career. And it's not just, you know, a career class here or a career class there. It's
like they're not just doing a grab bag.
Exactly.
We call that concentration, right? A concentrated sequence. So
yeah,
I think that's a really good point, because sometimes when these programs aren't organized that way and kids just kind of take a smattering of this or that, we don't see those same impacts.
Some evidence that these kids were engaged.
Yes.
A word that we care a lot about around here.
We do.
And we'll be looking into. In the future.
We don't know. I was curious about, like, who are these teachers, which is another point Checker brings up when we start talking about some programs like these dual enrollment and whatnot. Mm-hmm. You know, are these like practicing people in industry teaching these things? But you would think so, right?
Yeah.
In the area where it's located. So
super cool.
Did they go into it all? Sorry, one last question. Is it a like smaller school within a larger high school, like schools?
Mm. It is. It's just like they're in one part of the building and then there's everybody else.
Yeah.
So.
Very cool.
Yeah. Awesome. All right. Thanks, Amber.
Sure.
I love it. That's all the time we've got for this week. Until next week.
I'm Alyssa Schwenk.
And I'm Mike Petrilli at the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net.